key part of the doctor's job is diagnosis. So, buying the prediction is not a doctor's core strategic decision. Doctors continue to do what they did before, with an additional piece of information. If it isn't a key strategic decision, then they can buy the prediction without needing to own the data or prediction. In contrast, the essence of the startup is AI, and the prediction provides value to customers. So, as long as the startup owns the data and prediction machine, it does not need to own the diagnosis. The boundary between the startup and the doctor is the boundary where the AI ceases to be strategic, and instead is simply an input to a different process. Key points. A key strategic choice is determining where your business ends and another business begins. Deciding on the boundary of the firm. For example, airline partnerships, outsourcing automotive part manufacturing. Uncertainty influences this choice. Because prediction machines reduce uncertainty, they can influence the boundary between your organization and others. By reducing uncertainty, prediction machines increase the ability to write contracts, and thus increase the incentive for companies to contract out both capital equipment and labor that focuses on data, prediction, and action. However, prediction machines decrease the incentive for companies to contract out labor that focuses on judgment. Judgment quality is hard to specify in a contract and difficult to monitor. If judgment could be well specified, then it could be programmed, and we wouldn't need humans to provide it. Since judgment is likely to be the key role for human labor, as AI diffuses, in-house employment will rise, and contracting out labor will fall. AI will increase incentives to own data. Still, contracting out for data may be necessary when the predictions that the data provides are not strategically essential to your organization. In such cases, it may be best to purchase predictions directly rather than purchase data and then generate your own predictions. 17. Your learning strategy. In March 2017, in a keynote speech at its annual I/O event, Google CEO Sundar Pichai announced that the company was shifting from a mobile-first world to an AI-first world. Then a series of announcements followed involving AI in various ways, from the development of specialized chips for optimizing machine learning to the use of deep learning in new applications, including cancer research, to putting Google's AI-driven assistant on as many devices as possible. Pichai claimed the company was transitioning from searching and organizing the world's information to AI and machine learning. The announcement was more strategic than a fundamental change in vision. Google's founder, Larry Page, outlined this path in 2002. "We don't always produce what people want. That's what we work on really hard. It's really difficult. To do that, you have to be smart. You have to understand everything in the world. You have to understand the query. What we're trying to do is artificial intelligence. The ultimate search engine would be smart. And so we work to get closer and closer to that." In this sense, Google has considered itself on the path to building artificial intelligence for years. Only recently has it openly and outwardly put AI techniques at the heart of everything it does. Google is not alone in this strategic commitment. That same month, Microsoft announced its AI-first intentions, moving away from mobile-first and also cloud-first. But what does the notion of AI-first mean? For both Google and Microsoft, the first part of their change, no longer mobile-first, gives us a clue. To be mobile-first is to drive traffic to your mobile experience and optimize consumers' interfaces for mobile, even at the expense of your full website and other platforms. The last part is what makes it strategic. Do well on mobile is something to aim for. But saying you will do so, even if it harms other channels, is a real commitment. What does this mean in the context of AI first? Google's research director, Peter Norvig, gives an answer. With information retrieval, anything over 80% recall and precision is pretty good. Not every suggestion has to be perfect, since the user can ignore the bad suggestions. With assistance, there is a much higher barrier. You wouldn't use a service that booked the wrong reservation 20% of the time, or even 2% of the time. So an assistant needs to be much more accurate, and thus more intelligent, more aware of the situation. That's what we call AI first. That's a good answer for a computer scientist. It emphasizes technical performance and accuracy in particular. But this statement implicitly says something else, too. If AI is first, maximizing predictive accuracy, what becomes second? The Economist's filter knows that any statement of, "we will put our attention into X," means a trade-off. Something will always be given up in exchange. What does it take to emphasize predictive accuracy above all else? Our answer comes from our core economic framework. AI first means devoting resources to data collection and learning, a longer-term objective, at the expense of important short-term considerations, such as immediate customer experience, revenue, and user numbers. A whiff of disruption. Adopting an AI-first strategy is a commitment to prioritize prediction quality and to support the machine learning process, even at the cost of short-term factors such as consumer satisfaction and operational performance. Gathering data might mean deploying AIs whose prediction quality is not yet at optimal levels. The central strategic dilemma is whether to prioritize that learning or instead shield others from the performance sacrifices that entails. Different businesses will approach this dilemma and make choices differently. But why are Google, Microsoft, and other tech companies going AI first? Is that something other businesses can follow? Or is there something special about those companies? One distinguishing feature of these companies is that they are already gathering and generating great swaths of digital data and operating in environments with uncertainty. So prediction machines are likely to enable tools that they will use extensively throughout products in their business. Internally, tools that involve superior and cheaper prediction are in demand. Alongside this is a supply-side advantage. These companies already house technical talent that they can use to develop machine learning and its applications. These companies, drawing on the hybrid corn analogy from Chapter 15, are like the farmers located in Iowa. But AI-led technologies display another important characteristic. Given that learning takes time and often results in inferior performance, especially for consumers, it shares features of what Clay Christensen has termed disruptive technologies, meaning that some established companies will find it difficult to adopt such technologies quickly. Consider a new AI version of an existing product. To develop the product, it needs users. The first users of the AI product will have a poor customer experience because the AI needs to learn. A company may have a solid customer base and therefore could have those customers use the product and provide training data. However, those customers are happy with the existing product and may not tolerate a switch to a temporarily inferior AI product. This is the classic innovator's dilemma, whereby established firms do not want to disrupt their existing customer relationships, even if doing so would be better in the long run. The innovator's dilemma occurs because when they first appear, innovations might not be good enough to serve the customers of the established companies in an industry. But they may be good enough to provide a new startup with enough customers in some niche area to build a product. Over time, the startup gains experience. Eventually, the startup has learned enough to create a strong product that takes away its larger rivals' customers. By that point, the larger company is too far behind, and the startup eventually dominates. AI requires learning, and startups may be more willing to invest in this learning than their more established rivals. The innovator's dilemma is less of a dilemma when the company in question faces tough competition, especially if that competition comes from new entrants that do not face constraints associated with having to satisfy an existing customer base. In that situation, the threat of the competition means that the cost of doing nothing is too high. Such competition tips the equation toward adopting the disruptive technology quickly, even if you are an established company. Put differently, for technologies like AI, where the long-term potential impact is likely to be enormous, the whiff of disruption may drive early adoption, even by incumbents. Learning can take a great deal of data and time before a machine's predictions become reliably accurate. It will be a rare instance indeed when a prediction machine just works off the shelf. Someone selling you an AI-powered piece of software may have already done the hard work of training. But when you want to manage AI for a purpose core to your own business, no off-the-shelf solution is likely. You won't need a user manual so much as a training manual. This training requires some way for the AI to gather data and improve. A pathway to learning. Learning by using is a term that economic historian Nathan Rosenberg coined to describe the phenomenon whereby firms improve their product design through interactions with users. His main applications had to do with the performance of airplanes, whose more conservative initial designs gave way to better designs with larger capacity and greater efficiency as the airplane manufacturers learned through additional use. Manufacturers with an early start had an advantage as they learned more. Of course, such learning curves give strategic advantage in a variety of contexts. They are particularly important for prediction machines, which, after all, rely on machine learning. Thus far, we have not spent much time distinguishing between the different types of learning that make up machine learning. We have focused mostly on supervised learning. You use this technique when you already have good data on what you are trying to predict. For example, you have millions of images, and you already know that they contain a cat or a tumor. You train the AI based on that knowledge. Supervised learning is a key part of what we do as professors. We present new material by showing our students problems and their solutions. By contrast, what happens when you do not have good data on what you are trying to predict, but you can tell after the fact how right you were? In that situation, as we discussed in Chapter 2, computer scientists deploy techniques of reinforcement learning. Many young children and animals learn this way. The psychologist Pavlov rang a bell when giving dogs a treat, and then found that ringing the bell triggered a saliva response in those dogs. The dogs learned to associate the bell with receiving food, and came to know that a bell predicted nearby food and prepared accordingly. In AI, much progress in reinforcement learning has come in teaching machines to play games. DeepMind gave its AI a set of controls to video games, such as Breakout, and rewarded the AI for getting a higher score without any other instructions. The AI learned to play a host of Atari games better than the best human players. This is learning by using. The AIs played the game thousands of times and learned to play better, just as a human would, except the AI could play more games more quickly than any human ever could. Learning occurs by having the machine make certain moves, and then using the move data, along with past experience of moves and resulting scores, to predict which moves will lead to the biggest increases in score. The only way to learn is to actually play. Without a pathway to learning, the machine will neither play well nor improve over time. Such pathways to learning are costly. When to deploy. Those familiar with software development know that code needs extensive testing to locate bugs. In some situations, companies release the software to users to help find the bugs that might emerge in ordinary use, whether by dogfooding, forcing early versions of software to be used internally, or beta testing, inviting early adopters to test the software. These forms of learning by using involve a short-term investment in learning to enable the product to improve over time. This short-term cost of training for a longer-term benefit is similar to the way humans learn to do their jobs better. While it does not take a tremendous amount of training to begin a job as a crew member at McDonald's, new employees are slower and make more mistakes than their more experienced peers. They improve as they serve more customers. Commercial airline pilots also continue to improve from on-the-job experience. On January 15, 2009, when U.S. Airways Flight 1549 was struck by a flock of Canada geese, shutting down all engine power, Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger miraculously landed the plane on the Hudson River, saving the lives of all 155 passengers. Most reporters attributed his performance to experience. He had recorded 19,663 total flight hours, including 4,765 flying an Airbus A320. Sully himself reflected, "One way of looking at this might be that for 42 years I've been making small, regular deposits in this bank of experience, education, and training. And on January 15th, the balance was sufficient so that I could make a very large withdrawal." Sully and all his passengers benefited from the thousands of people he'd flown before. The difference between the skills of new cashiers and pilots in what constitutes good enough to get started is based on tolerance for error. Obviously, our tolerance is much lower for pilots. We take comfort that pilot certification is regulated by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Aviation Administration and requires a minimum experience of 1,500 hours of flight time, 500 hours of cross-country flight time, 100 hours of night flight time, and 75 hours of instrument operations time, even though pilots continue to learn from on-the-job experience. We have different definitions for good enough when it comes to how much training humans require in different jobs. The same is true of machines that learn. Companies design systems to train new employees until they are good enough, and then deploy them into service, knowing they will improve as they learn from experience doing their job. But determining what constitutes good enough is a critical decision. In the case of prediction machines, it can be a major strategic decision regarding timing, when to shift from in-house training to on-the-job learning. There are no ready answers for what constitutes good enough for prediction machines, only trade-offs. Success with prediction machines will require taking these trade-offs seriously and approaching them strategically. First, what tolerance do people have for error? We have high tolerance for error with some prediction machines and low tolerance for others. For example, Google's Inbox app reads our email, uses AI to predict how we may want to respond, and generates three short responses to choose from. Many users report enjoying using the app, even though it has a 70% failure rate. At the time of writing, the AI-generated response is only useful for us about 30% of the time. The reason for this high tolerance for error is that the benefit of reduced composing and typing outweighs the cost of providing suggestions and wasting screen real estate when the predicted short response is wrong. In contrast, we have low tolerance for error in the realm of autonomous driving. The first generation of autonomous vehicles, which Google largely pioneered, was trained using specialist human drivers who took a limited number of vehicles and drove them hundreds of thousands of kilometers, much like a parent supervising a teenager on driving experiences. Such human specialist drivers provide a safe training environment, but they are also extremely limited. The machine only learns about a few situations. Someone may take many millions of miles in varying environments and situations before they have learned how to deal with the rare incidents that lead to accidents. For autonomous vehicles, real roads are nasty and unforgiving, precisely because nasty or unforgiving human-caused situations can occur on them. Second, how important is capturing user data in the real world? Understanding that training might take a prohibitively long time, Tesla rolled out autonomous vehicle capabilities to all of its recent models. These capabilities included a set of sensors that collect environmental data, as well as driving data, which is uploaded to Tesla's machine learning servers. In a very short time, Tesla can obtain training data just by observing how the drivers of its cars drive. The more Tesla vehicles are on the road, the more Tesla's machines can learn. However, in addition to passively collecting data as humans drive their Teslas, the company needs autonomous driving data to understand how its autonomous systems are operating. For that, it needs to have cars drive autonomously, so that it can assess performance, but also analyze when a human driver, whose presence and attention are required, chooses to intervene. Tesla's ultimate goal is not to produce a co-pilot or a teenager who drives under supervision, but a fully autonomous vehicle. That requires getting to the point where real people feel comfortable in a self-driving car. Herein lies a tricky trade-off. To get better, Tesla needs its machines to learn in real situations. But putting its current cars in real situations means giving customers a relatively young and inexperienced driver, although perhaps as good as or better than many young human drivers. Still, this is far riskier than beta testing, whether Siri or Alexa understood what you said, or if Google Inbox correctly predicts your response to an email. In the case of Siri, Alexa, or Google Inbox, a mistake means a lower quality user experience. In the case of autonomous vehicles, a mistake means putting lives at risk. That experience can be scary. Cars can exit freeways without notice, or press the brakes when mistaking an underpass for an obstruction. Nervous drivers may opt not to use the autonomous features and, in the process, hinder Tesla's ability to learn. Even if the company can persuade some people to become beta testers, are those the people it wants? After all, a beta tester for autonomous driving may be someone with a taste for more risk than the average driver. In that case, who is the company training its machines to be like? Machines learn faster with more data. And when machines are deployed in the wild, they generate more data. However, bad things can happen in the real world and damage the company brand. Putting products in the wild earlier accelerates learning but risks harming the brand, and perhaps the customer. Putting them out later slows learning, but allows for more time to improve the product in-house and protect the brand, and again, perhaps the customer. For some products, like Google Inbox, the answer to the trade-off seems clear, because the cost of poor performance is low, and the benefits from learning from customer usage are high. It makes sense to deploy this type of product in the real world early. For other products, like cars, the answer is murkier. As more companies across all industries seek to take advantage of machine learning, strategies associated with choosing how to handle this trade-off will become increasingly salient. Learning by simulation. One intermediate step to soften this trade-off is to use simulated environments. When human pilots are training before they get their hands on a real plane in flight, they spend hundreds of hours in what are very sophisticated and realistic simulators. A similar approach is available for AI. Google trained DeepMind's AlphaGo AI to defeat the best Go players in the world, not just by looking at thousands of games played between humans, but also by playing against another version of itself. One form of this approach is called adversarial machine learning, which pits the main AI and its objective against another AI that tries to foil that objective. For example, Google researchers had one AI send messages to another using an encryption process. The two AIs shared a key to encoding and decoding the message. A third AI, the adversary, had the messages but not the key and tried to decode them. With many simulations, the adversary trained the main AI to communicate in ways that are hard to decode without the key. Such simulated learning approaches cannot take place on the ground. They require something akin to a laboratory approach that produces a new machine learning algorithm that is then copied and pushed out to users. The advantage is that the machine is not trained in the wild, so the risk to the user experience, or even to the users themselves, is mitigated. The disadvantage is that simulations may not provide sufficiently rich feedback, reducing, but not eliminating, the need to release the AI early. Eventually, you have to let the AI loose in the real world. Learning in the cloud versus on the ground. Learning in the wild improves the AI. The company can then use real-world outcomes that the prediction machine experiences to improve the predictions for next time. Often, a company collects data in the real world, which refines the machine before it releases an updated prediction model. Tesla's autopilot never learns on the job with actual consumers. When it is out in the field, it sends the data back to Tesla's computing cloud. Tesla then aggregates and uses that data to upgrade autopilot. Only then does it roll out a new version of autopilot. Learning takes place in the cloud. This standard approach has the advantage of shielding users from undertrained versions. The downside, however, is that the common AI that resides on devices cannot take into account rapidly changing local conditions, or, at the very least, can only do so when that data is built into a new generation. Thus, from the perspective of a user, improvements come in jumps. By contrast, imagine if the AI could learn on the device and improve in that environment. It could then respond more readily to local conditions and optimize itself for different environments. In environments where things change rapidly, it is beneficial to improve the prediction machines on the devices themselves. For example, on apps like Tinder, the popular dating app where users make selections by swiping left for no or right for yes, users make many decisions rapidly. This can feed into the predictions immediately to determine which potential dates to show next. Tastes are user-specific and change over time, both over the course of a year and by time of day. To the extent that people are similar and have stable preferences, sending to the cloud and updating will work well. To the extent that an individual's tastes are idiosyncratic and rapidly changing, then the ability to adjust predictions at the level of the device is useful. Companies must trade off how quickly they should use a prediction machine's experience in the real world to generate new predictions. Use that experience immediately, and the AI adapts more quickly to changes in local conditions, but at the cost of quality assurance. Permission to learn. Learning often requires customers who are willing to provide data. If strategy involves doing something at the expense of something else, then in the AI space, few companies made a stronger earlier commitment than Apple. Tim Cook wrote in a special section devoted to privacy on Apple's homepage, "At Apple, your trust means everything to us. That's why we respect your privacy and protect it with strong encryption, plus strict policies that govern how all data is handled." He went on. A few years ago, users of internet services began to realize that when an online service is free, you're not the customer, you're the product. But at Apple, we believe a great customer experience shouldn't come at the expense of your privacy. Our business model is very straightforward. We sell great products. We don't build a profile based on your email content or web browsing habits to sell to advertisers. We don't monetize the information you store on your iPhone or in iCloud, and we don't read your email or your messages to get information to market to you. Our software and services are designed to make our devices better, plain and simple. Apple did not make this decision due to a government regulation. Some claimed Apple made the decision because it was purportedly lagging behind Google and Facebook in developing AI. No company, certainly not Apple, could eschew AI. This commitment would make its job harder. It plans to do AI in a way that respects privacy. It is making a big strategic bet that consumers will want control over their own data. Whether for security or privacy, Apple has bet that its commitment will make consumers more, not less likely to allow AI onto their devices. Apple isn't alone in betting that protecting privacy will pay off. Salesforce, Adobe, Uber, Dropbox, and many others have invested heavily in privacy. This bet is strategic. Many other companies, including Google, Facebook, and Amazon, have chosen a different path, telling users that they will use data to provide better products. Apple's focus on privacy limits the products it can offer. For instance, both Apple and Google have face recognition built into their photo services. To be useful to consumers, the faces have to be tagged. Google does this, preserving the tags, regardless of device, since the recognition runs on Google servers. Apple, however, because of privacy concerns, has opted to have that recognition occur at the device level. That means, if you tag faces of people you know on your Mac, the tags will not carry over to your iPhone or iPad. Not surprisingly, this creates a situation where privacy concerns and consumer usability hit a roadblock. How Apple will deal with these issues is unknown at the time of writing. We do not know what will emerge in practice. In any case, our economist filter makes it clear that the relative payoffs associated with trading people's privacy concerns for predictive accuracy will guide the ultimate strategic choice. Enhanced privacy might give companies permission to learn about consumers, but may also mean the learning is not particularly useful. Experience is the new scarce resource. Navigation app Waze collects data from other Waze users to predict the location of traffic problems. It can find the fastest route for you personally. If that were all it was doing, there would be no issue. However, prediction alters human behavior, which is what Waze is designed to do. When the machine receives information from a crowd, its predictions may be distorted by that fact. For Waze, the problem is that its users will follow its guidance to avoid traffic problems, perhaps through side streets. Unless Waze adjusts for this, it will never be alerted that a traffic problem is alleviated and the normal route is once again the fastest. To overcome this obstacle, the app must therefore send some human drivers back toward the traffic jam to see if it is still there. Doing so presents the obvious issue. Humans, so directed, might be sacrificial lambs for the greater good of the crowd. Not surprisingly, this degrades the quality of the product for them. There are no easy ways to overcome the trade-off that arises when prediction alters crowd behavior, thereby denying AI of the very information it needs to form the correct prediction. In this instance, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one. But this is certainly not a comfortable way of thinking about managing customer relationships. Sometimes, to improve products, especially when they involve learning by using, it is important to jolt the system so the consumers actually experience something new that the machine can learn from. Customers who are forced into that new environment often have a worse experience, but everyone else benefits from those experiences. For beta testing, the trade-off is voluntary, as customers opt into the early versions. But beta testing may attract customers who do not use the product the same way as your general customers would. To gain experience about all your customers, you may sometimes need to degrade the product for those customers in order to get feedback that will benefit everyone. Humans also need experience. The scarcity of experience becomes even more salient when you consider the experience of your human resources. If the machines get the experience, then the humans might not. Recently, some expressed concern that automation could result in the de-skilling of humans. Air France Flight 447 crashed into the Atlantic en route from Rio de Janeiro to Paris in 2009. The crisis began with bad weather, but escalated when the plane's autopilot disengaged. At the helm during that time, unlike Sully in the U.S. Airways plane, a relatively inexperienced pilot poorly handled the situation, according to reports. When a more experienced pilot took over, he had been asleep, he was unable to properly assess the situation. The experienced pilot had slept little the night before. The bottom line? The junior pilot may have had almost 3,000 hours in the air, but it was not quality experience. Most of the time, he had been flying the plane on autopilot. Automation of flying has become commonplace, a reaction to evidence that showed that most airplane accidents after the 1970s were the result of human error. So, humans have since been removed from the control loop. However, the ironic unintended consequence is that human pilots garner less experience and become even worse. For economist Tim Harford, the solution is obvious. Automation has to be scaled back. What is being automated, he argues, are more routine situations. So you require human interventions for more extreme situations. If the way you learn to deal with the extreme is by having a great feel for the ordinary, therein lies a problem. The Air France plane faced an extreme situation without the proper attention of an experienced hand. Harford stresses that automation does not always lead to this conundrum. There are plenty of situations in which automation creates no such paradox. A customer service webpage may be able to handle routine complaints and requests so that staff are spared repetitive work and may do a better job for customers with more complex questions. Not so with an airplane. Autopilots and the more subtle assistance of fly-by-wire do not free up the crew to concentrate on the interesting stuff. Instead, they free up the crew to fall asleep at the controls, figuratively, or even literally. One notorious incident occurred late in 2009 when two pilots let their autopilot overshoot Minneapolis Airport by more than 100 miles. They had been looking at their laptops. Not surprisingly, other examples we've discussed in this book tend to fall into the category of airplanes rather than customer service complaints, including the whole domain of self-driving cars. What will we do when we don't drive most of the time, but have a car that hands control to us during an extreme event? What will our children do? The solutions involve ensuring that humans gain and retain skills, reducing the amount of automation to provide time for human learning. In effect, experience is a scarce resource, some of which you need to allocate to humans to avoid de-skilling. The reverse logic is also true. To train prediction machines, having them learn through the experience of potentially catastrophic events is surely valuable. But if you put a human in the loop, how will that machine's experience emerge? And so, another trade-off in generating a pathway to learning is between human and machine experience. These trade-offs reveal the implications of the AI-first declarations of the leadership of Google, Microsoft, and others. The companies are willing to invest in data to help their machines learn. Improving prediction machines takes priority, even if that requires degrading the quality of the immediate customer experience or employee training. Data strategy is key to AI strategy. Key points. Shifting to an AI-first strategy means downgrading the previous top priority. In other words, AI-first is not a buzzword. It represents a real trade-off. An AI-first strategy places maximizing prediction accuracy as the central goal of the organization, even if that means compromising on other goals, such as maximizing revenue, user numbers, or user experience. AI can lead to disruption because incumbent firms often have weaker economic incentives than startups to adopt the technology. AI-enabled products are often inferior at first because it takes time to train a prediction machine to perform as well as a hard-coded device that follows human instructions rather than learning on its own. However, once deployed, an AI can continue to learn and improve, leaving its unintelligent competitors' products behind. It is tempting for established companies to take a wait-and-see approach, standing on the sidelines and observing the progress in AI applied to their industry. That may work for some companies, but others will find it difficult to catch up once their competitors get ahead in the training and deployment of their AI tools. Another strategic decision concerns timing, when to release AI tools into the wild. AI tools are initially trained in-house, away from customers. However, they learn faster when they are deployed into commercial use because they are exposed to real operating conditions and often to greater volumes of data. The benefit to deploying earlier is faster learning, and the cost is greater risk. Risk to the brand or customer safety by exposing customers to immature AIs that are not properly trained. In some cases, the trade-off is clear, such as with Google Inbox, where the benefits of faster learning outweigh the cost of poor performance. In other cases, such as autonomous driving, the trade-off is more ambiguous, given the size of the prize for being early with a commercial product weighed against the high cost of an error if the product is released before it is ready. 18. Managing AI risk. LaTanya Sweeney, who was the Chief Technology Officer for the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and is now a professor at Harvard University, was surprised when a colleague Googled her name to find one of her papers and discovered ads suggesting she had been arrested. Sweeney clicked on the ad, paid a fee, and learned what she already knew. She had never been arrested. Intrigued, she entered the name of her colleague, Adam Tanner, and the same company's ad appeared but without the suggestion of arrest. After more searching, she developed the hypothesis that maybe black-sounding names were triggering the arrest ad. Sweeney then tested this more systematically and found that if you Googled a black-associated name like Lakeisha or Trayvon, you were 25% more likely to get an ad suggesting an arrest record than if you searched for a name like Jill or Joshua. Such biases are potentially damaging. Searchers might be looking for information to see if someone is suitable for a job. If they find ads with titles like LaTanya Sweeney, Arrested, the searchers might have some doubts. It is both discriminatory and defamatory. Why was this happening? Google provides software that allows advertisers to test and target particular keywords. Advertisers might have entered racially associated names to place ads alongside, although Google denied that. Another possibility is that the pattern emerged as a result of Google's algorithms, which promote ads that have a higher quality score, meaning they are likely to be clicked. Prediction machines likely played a role there. For instance, if potential employers searching for names were more likely to click on an arrest ad when associated with a black-sounding name than other names, then the quality score associated with placing those ads with such keywords might rise. Google is not intending to be discriminatory, but its algorithms might amplify prejudices that already exist in society. Such profiling exemplifies a risk of implementing AI. Liability risks. The emergence of racial profiling is a societal issue, but also a potential problem for companies like Google. They may run afoul of employment anti-discrimination rules. Fortunately, when whistleblowers like Sweeney raise the issue, Google is highly responsive, investigating and correcting problems. Discrimination might emerge in even subtler ways. Economists Anya Lumbrecht and Catherine Tucker, in a 2017 study, showed that Facebook ads could lead to gender discrimination. They placed ads promoting jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM fields, on the social network, and found Facebook was less likely to show the ad to women, not because women were less likely to click on the ad, or because they might be in countries with discriminatory labor markets. On the contrary, the workings of the ad market discriminated. Because younger women are valuable as a demographic on Facebook, showing ads to them is more expensive. So when you place an ad on Facebook, the algorithms naturally place ads where their return per placement is highest. If men and women are equally likely to click on STEM job ads, then it is better to place ads where they are cheap, with men. Harvard Business School professor, economist, and lawyer Ben Edelman explained to us why this issue could be serious for both employers and Facebook. While many tend to think of discrimination as arising from disparate treatment, setting different standards for men and women, the ad placement differences might result in what lawyers call disparate impact. A gender-neutral procedure turns out to affect some employees who might have reason to fear discrimination, a protected class to lawyers, differently from others. A person or an organization can be liable for discrimination, even if it is accidental. A court found that the New York City Fire Department discriminated against Black and Hispanic applicants becoming firefighters with an entrance exam that included several questions emphasizing reading comprehension. The court found that the types of questions had no relation to effectiveness as a fire department employee, and that Black and Hispanic applicants performed systematically worse on them. The case was eventually settled for about $99 million. Blacks and Hispanics' lower performance on the exam meant that the department was liable, even if the discrimination was unintentional. So while you may think you are placing a neutral ad on Facebook, disparate impact might be emerging regardless. As an employer, you could be liable. Of course, you don't want to engage in discrimination, even implicitly. One solution for Facebook is to offer tools for advertisers to prevent discrimination. A challenge with AI is that such unintentional discrimination can happen without anyone in the organization noticing. Predictions generated by deep learning and many other AI technologies appear to be created from a black box. It isn't feasible to look at the algorithm or formula underlying the prediction and identify what causes what. To figure out if AI is discriminating, you have to look at the output. Do men get different results than women? Do Hispanics get different results than others? What about the elderly or the disabled? Do these different results limit their opportunities? To prevent liability issues and to avoid being discriminatory, if you discover unintentional discrimination in the output of your AI, you need to fix it. You need to figure out why your AI generated discriminatory predictions. But if AI is a black box, then how can you do this? Some in the computer science community call this AI neuroscience. A key tool is to hypothesize what might drive the differences, provide the AI with different input data that tests the hypothesis, and then compare the resulting predictions. Lambrecht and Tucker did this when they discovered that women saw fewer STEM ads because it was less expensive to show the ad to men. Point is that the black box of AI is not an excuse to ignore potential discrimination or a way to avoid using AI in situations where discrimination might matter. Plenty of evidence shows that humans discriminate even more than machines. Deploying AI requires additional investments in auditing for discrimination, then working to reduce any discrimination that results. Algorithmic discrimination can easily emerge at the operational level, but can end up having strategic and broader consequences. Strategy involves directing those in your organization to weigh factors that might not otherwise be obvious. This becomes particularly salient with systematic risks, like algorithmic discrimination, that may have a negative impact on your business. Showing the STEM ads to men and not women bolstered short-term performance, in that the ads the men saw cost less, but created risks due to the resulting discrimination. The consequences of increasing risks may not become apparent until too late. Thus, a key task for a business's leaders is to anticipate various risks and ensure that procedures are in place to manage them. Quality risks. If you are in a consumer-facing business, you probably buy ads and have seen a measure of those ads' ROI. For instance, your organization may have found that paying for Google Ads resulted in an increase in click-throughs, and maybe even purchases on the website. That is, the more ads your company bought on Google, the more clicks from those ads it received. Now, try employing an AI to look at that data and generate a prediction of whether a new Google ad is likely to increase clicks from that ad. The AI will likely back up that positive correlation you had previously observed. As a result, when the marketing people want to buy more Google ads, they have some ROI evidence to back it up. Of course, it takes an ad to generate a click. One possibility is that without the ad, the consumer would never know about your product. In this case, you want to place ads because they generate new sales. Another possibility is that the ad is the easiest thing for potential customers to click. But in its absence, they would find you anyway. So while the ad may be associated with more sales, it is potentially a fiction. Without the ad, sales may have increased regardless. Thus, if you really want to know if the ad, and the money you spend on it, is generating new sales, you need to examine the situation more deeply. In 2012, some economists working for eBay, Thomas Blake, Chris Nosko, and Steve Dedalus, persuaded eBay to turn off all of its search advertising in one-third of the United States for an entire month. The ads had a measured ROI using traditional statistics of more than 4,000%. If the measured ROI was correct, doing a month-long experiment would cost eBay a fortune. However, what they found justified their approach. The search ads eBay placed had practically no impact on sales. Their ROI was negative. Consumers on eBay were savvy enough that if they didn't see an ad in Google, they would click on ordinary or organic search results in Google. Google would highly rank eBay listings regardless. But the same was true for brands like BMW and Amazon. The only area where ads seemed to do some good was in attracting new users to eBay. This story's point is to demonstrate that AI, which does not rely on causal experimentation, but on correlation, can easily fall into the same traps as anyone using data and simple statistics can. If you want to know whether advertising is effective, observe whether ads lead to sales. However, that is not necessarily the full story, because you also need to know what would happen to sales if you ran no ads. An AI trained on data that involves lots of ads and sales does not get to see what happens with few ads. That data is missing. Such unknown knowns are a key weakness of prediction machines that require human judgment to overcome. At the moment, only thoughtful humans can work out if the AI is falling into that trap. Security risks. While software has always been subject to security risks, with AI, those risks emerge through the possibility of data manipulation. Three classes of data have an impact on prediction machines: input, training, and feedback. All three have potential security risks. Input data risks. Prediction machines feed on input data. They combine this data with a model to generate a prediction. So, just like the old computer adage, garbage in, garbage out, prediction machines fail if they have poor data or a bad model. A hacker might cause a prediction machine to fail by feeding it garbage data or manipulating the prediction model. One type of failure is a crash. Crashes might seem bad, but at least you know when they have occurred. When someone manipulates a prediction machine, you may not know about it, at least not until too late. Hackers have many ways to manipulate or fool a prediction machine. University of Washington researchers showed that Google's new algorithm for detecting video content could be fooled into misclassifying videos by inserting random images for fractions of a second. For example, you can trick an AI into misclassifying a video of a zoo by inserting images of cars for such a short time that a human would never see the cars, but the computer could. In an environment where publishers need to know content being published to appropriately match advertisers, this represents a critical vulnerability. Machines are generating predictions used for decision-making. Companies deploy them in situations where they really matter. That is, where we expect them to have a real impact on decisions. Without such decision embeddedness, Why go to the trouble of making a prediction in the first place? Sophisticated bad actors in this context would understand that by altering a prediction, they could adjust the decisions. For instance, a diabetic using an AI to optimize insulin intake could end up in serious jeopardy if the AI has incorrect data about that person and then offers predictions that suggest lowering insulin intake when it should be increased. If harming a person is someone's objective, then this is one way to do it effectively. We are most likely to deploy prediction machines in situations where prediction is hard. A bad actor might not find precisely what data is needed to manipulate a prediction. A machine may form a prediction based on a confluence of factors. A single lie in a web of truth is of little consequence. In many other situations, identifying some data that can be used to manipulate a prediction is straightforward. Examples might be location, date, and time of day. But identity is the most important. If a prediction is specific to a person, feeding the AI the wrong identity leads to bad consequences. AI technologies will develop hand-in-hand with identity verification. NIME, a startup we worked with, developed a technology that uses machine learning to identify individuals via their heartbeat. Others are using retina scans, faces, or fingerprint identification. Companies can also confirm an identity by using the characteristics of a smartphone user's walking patterns. Regardless, a happy confluence in technologies may emerge that allows us to simultaneously personalize AI and safeguard identity. While personalized predictions might be vulnerable to the manipulation of the individual, impersonal predictions may face their own set of risks related to population-level manipulation. Ecologists have taught us that homogeneous populations are at greater risk of disease and destruction. A classic example is in farming. If all farmers in a region or country plant the same strain of a particular crop, they might do better in the short term. They likely chose that crop because it grows particularly well in the region. By adopting the best strain, they reduce their individual risk. However, this very homogeneity presents an opportunity for disease or even adverse climate conditions. If all farmers plant the same strain, then they are all vulnerable to the same disease. The chances of a disastrous widespread crop failure increase. Such monoculture can be individually beneficial, but increase system-wide risk. This idea applies to information technology generally, and prediction machines in particular. If one prediction machine system proves itself particularly useful, then you might apply that system everywhere in your organization or even the world. All cars might adopt whatever prediction machine appears safest. That reduces individual-level risk and increases safety. However, it also expands the chance of a massive failure, whether purposeful or not. If all cars have the same prediction algorithm, an attacker might be able to exploit that algorithm, manipulate the data or model in some way, and have all cars fail at the same time. Just as in agriculture, homogeneity improves results at the individual level at the expense of multiplying the likelihood of system-wide failure. A seemingly easy solution to the problem of system-wide failure is to encourage diversity in the prediction machines you deploy. This will reduce the security risks, but at the cost of reduced performance. It might also increase the risk of incidental smaller failures due to a lack of standardization. Just as in biodiversity, the diversity of prediction machines involves a trade-off between individual and system-level outcomes. Many of the scenarios for system-wide failure involve an attack on several prediction machines at the same time. For example, an attack on one autonomous vehicle represents a risk to safety. An attack on all autonomous vehicles simultaneously presents a national security threat. Another way to secure against a massive simultaneous attack, even in the presence of standard homogeneous prediction machines, is to untether the device from the cloud. We have already discussed the benefits of implementing prediction on the ground rather than in the cloud for the purpose of faster context-dependent learning at the cost of more accurate predictions overall, and to protect consumer privacy. Prediction on the ground has another benefit. If the device is not connected to the cloud, a simultaneous attack becomes difficult. While training the prediction machine likely happens in the cloud or elsewhere, once the machine is trained, it may be possible to do predictions directly on the device,